Later, he went out and drove down to the quick stop. When he pulled back into the motel, he sat there studying the cars in the lot. Then he got out. He walked down to her room and tapped at the door. He waited. He tapped again. He saw the curtain move, and then she opened the door. She stood there in the same jeans and T-shirt. She looked like she'd just woken up. "I know you ain't old enough to drink, but I thought I'd see if you wanted a beer."
"Yeah," she said. "I'd drink a beer."
He lifted one of the cold bottles out of the brown paper bag and handed it to you. "Here you go," he said. He'd already turned to go. She stepped out and let the door shut behind her.
"You don't need to rush off that way," she said.
He stopped on the lower step.
"You got another one of these in that sack?"
"Yeah, I got two more, and I aim to drink both of them."
"I just meant maybe you could sit here and drink one of them with me."
He squinted at her. "You ever notice how women have trouble taking no for an answer? I think it starts about age 3.
"What about men?"
"They get used to it. They better."
"I won't say a word. I'll just sit here."
"You won't say a word?"
"No."
"Well, that's already a lie."
"Well, I won't say hardly nothing. I'll be real quiet."
He sat on the step and pulled one of the beers from the bag and twisted off the cap and tilted the bottle and drank. She sat on the next step up and did the same. "You sleep a lot?" he said.
"I sleep when I get the chance, yeah. You?"
"I ain't had a night's sleep in about 2 weeks. I don't know what it would feel like. I think it's beginning to make me stupid."
"You don't look stupid to me."
"Well, that's by your lights."
"What's that mean?"
"Nothing. I'm just ragging you. I'll quit."
"You ain't got drugs in that satchel, have you?"
"No, why? You use drugs?"
"I'd smoke some weed if you had some."
"Well, I ain't."
"That's all right."
Moss shook his head. He drank.
"I just meant it's all right. We could just sit out here and drink a beer."
"Well, I'm glad to hear that's all right."
"Where are you heading? You ain't never said."
"Hard to say."
"You ain't going to California, though, are you?"
"No, I ain't."
"I didn't think so."
"I'm going to El Paso."
"I thought you didn't know where you was going."
"Maybe I just decided."
"I don't think so."
Moss didn't answer.
"This is nice, setting out here," she said.
"I guess it depends on where you've been setting."
"You ain't just got out of the penitentiary or something, have you?"
"I just got off of death row. They done shaved my head for the electric chair. You can see where it started to grow back."
"You're full of it."
"Be funny if it turned out to be true, though, wouldn't it?"
"Is the law hunting you?"
"Everybody's hunting me."
"What did you do?"
"I've been picking up young girls hitchhiking and burying them out in the desert."
"That ain't funny."
"Yeah, you're right. It ain't. I was just pulling your leg."
"You said you'd quit."
"I will."
"Do you ever tell the truth?"
"Yeah, I tell the truth."
"You're married, ain't you?"
"Yeah."
"What's your wife's name?"
"Carla Jean."
"Is she in El Paso?"
"Yeah."
"Does she know what you do for a living?"
"Yeah, she knows. I'm a welder."
She watched him to see what else he'd say. He didn't say anything. "You ain't no welder," she said.
"Why ain't I?"
"What have you got that machine gun for?"
"'Cause they some bad people after me."
"What did you do to them?"
"I took something that belongs to them, and they want it back."
"That don't sound like welding to me."
"It don't, does it? I guess I hadn't thought of that."
He sipped the beer, holding it by the neck between his thumb and forefinger. "And that's what's in the bag, ain't it?"
"Hard to say."
"Are you a safecracker?"
"A safecracker?"
"Yeah."
"Whatever give you that notion?"
I don't know. Are you?
No.
Well, you're something, ain't you?
Everybody's something.
You ever been to California?
Yeah, I've been to California. I got a brother lives there.
Does he like it?
I don't know. He lives there.
You wouldn't live there, though, would you?
No.
You think that's where I ought to go?
He looked at her and looked away again. He stretched his legs out on the concrete and crossed his boots and looked out across the parking lot toward the highway and the lights on the highway. Darling, he said, how in the hell would I know where you ought to go?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you giving me that money.
You're welcome.
You didn't have to do that.
I thought you wasn't going to talk.
All right, that's a lot of money, though.
It ain't half what you think it is, you'll see.
I won't blow it in. I need money to get me a place to stay.
You'll be all right.
I hope so.
Best way to live in California is to be from somewheres else. Probably the best way is to be from Mars.
I hope not, 'cause I ain't.
You'll be all right.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah, go ahead.
How old are you?
36.
That's pretty old. I didn't know you was that old.
I know, it kind of took me by surprise my own self.
I got a feeling I ought to be afraid of you, but I ain't.
Well, I can't advise you on that neither. Most people will run from their own mother to get to hug death by the neck. They can't wait to see him.
I guess that's what you think I'm doing.
I don't even want to know what you're doing.
I wonder where I'd be right now if I hadn't have met you this morning.
I don't know.
I was always lucky about stuff like that, about meeting people.
Well, I wouldn't speak too soon.
Why, you fixing to bury me out in the desert?
No. But there's a lot of bad luck out there. You hang around long enough and you'll come in for your share of it.
I think I done have. I believe I'm due for a change. I might even be overdue.
Yeah. Well, you ain't.
Why do you say that?
He looked at her. Let me tell you something, little sister. If there is one thing on this planet that you don't look like, it's a bunch of good luck walking around.
That's a hateful thing to say.
No, it ain't. I just want you to be careful. We get to El Paso, I'm going to drop you at the bus station. You got money. You don't need to be out here hitchhiking.
All right.
All right.
Would you have done what you said back yonder? About if I'd have took your truck?
What's that?
You know, about beating the crap out of me?
No.
I didn't think so.
You want to split this last beer?
All right.
Run in there and get a cup. I'll be back in a minute.
All right. You ain't changed your mind, have you?
About what?
You know about what.
I don't change my mind. I like to get it right the first time.
He rose and started up the walkway. She stood at the door. I'll tell you something I heard in a movie one time, she said.
He stopped and turned. What's that?
There's a lot of good salesmen around, and you might buy something yet.
Well, darling, you're just a little late, 'cause I done bought, and I think I'll stick with what I got.
He went on up the walkway and climbed the stairs and went in.
The Barracuda pulled into a truck stop outside of Balmoray and drove into the bay of the adjoining car wash. The driver got out and shut the door and looked at it. There was blood and other matter streaked over the glass and over the sheet metal, and he walked out and got quarters from a change machine and came back and put them in the slot and took down the wand from the rack and washed the car and rinsed it off and got back in and pulled out onto the highway going west. Belle left the house at 7:30 and took 285 north to Fort Stockton.
It was about a 200-mile run to Van Horn, and he reckoned he could make it in under 3 hours. He turned the roof lights on. About 10 miles west of Fort Stockton, on the I-10 interstate, he passed a car burning by the side of the highway. There were police cars at the scene, and one lane of the highway was blocked off. He didn't stop, but it gave him an uneasy feeling. He stopped at Balmoray and refilled his coffee bottle, and he pulled into Van Horn at 10:25. He didn't know what he was looking for, but he didn't have to. In the parking lot of a motel, there were 2 Culberson County patrol cars and a state police car, all with their lights going. The motel was cordoned off with yellow tape. He pulled in and parked and left his own lights on. The deputy didn't know him, but the sheriff did. They were questioning a man sitting in his shirt sleeves in the open back door of one of the cruisers.
"Damn, if bad news don't travel fast," the sheriff said. "What are you doing up here, sheriff?"
"What's happened, Marvin?"
"Had a little shootout. You know anything about this?"
"I don't know. You got any victims?"
"They left out of here about a half hour ago in the ambulance. 2 men and a woman. The woman was dead, and the one boy I don't think is going to make it either. The other one might."
"Do you know who they were?"
"No. One of the men was Mexican, and we're waiting for a registration on his car sitting over yonder. Wasn't a one of them had any identification on him or in the room, either one."
"What does this man say?"
"He says the Mexican started it. Says he drugged the woman out of her room and the other man come out with a gun, but when he seen the Mexican had a gun pointed at the woman's head, he laid his own piece down. And whenever he done that, the Mexican shoved the woman away and shot her and then turned and shot him. He was standing in front of 117 right yonder. Shot him with a goddamn machine gun. According to this witness, the old boy fell down the steps and then he picked up his gun again and shot the Mexican. Which I don't see how he done it. He was shot all to pieces. You can see the blood on the walkway yonder. We had a real good response time, about 7 minutes, I think. The girl was just shot dead."
"No ID?"
"No ID. The other old boy's truck has got dealer tags on it."
Bell nodded. He looked at the witness. The witness had asked for a cigarette, and he lit it and sat smoking. He looked pretty comfortable. He looked as if he'd sat in the back of police cruisers before.
"That woman," Bell said, "was she Anglo?"
"Yeah, she was Anglo. Had blonde hair, sort of reddish, maybe."
"Did y'all find any dope?"
"Not yet. We're still looking."
"Any money?"
"We ain't found nothing yet. The girl was checked into 121, had a knapsack with some clothes in it and stuff was all."
Bell looked down the row of motel doors, people standing around in small groups talking. He looked at the black Barracuda.
"Has that thing got anything to turn them tires with?"
"I'd say it would turn them pretty good. It's got a 440 under the hood with a blower on it."
"A blower?"
"Yep."
"I don't see one."
"It's one of them sidewinders. It's all under the hood."
Bell stood looking at the car. Then he turned and looked at the sheriff.
"Can you get away from here for a minute?"
"I can. What did you have in mind?"
"I just thought I might get you to ride over to the clinic with me."
"All right. Just ride with me."
"That'll be fine. Let me just park my cruiser a little better."
"Hell, it's all right, Ed Tom.
Just let me pull it up here out of the way. You don't always know how quick you'll be back when you set off someplace."
At the desk, the sheriff spoke to the night nurse by name. She looked at Bell.
"He's up here to make a identification," the sheriff said.
She nodded and rose and put her pencil in the pages of the book she was reading.
2 of them were DOA," she said. "They flew that Mexican out of here in a helicopter about 20 minutes ago, or maybe you already knew that."
"Nobody tells me nothing, darling," the sheriff said.
They followed her down the hallway. There was a thin trail of blood along the concrete floor.
"They wouldn't have been hard to find, would they?"
Bell said. There was a red sign at the end of the hall that read exit. Before they got there, she turned and fitted a key to a steel door on the left and opened it and switched on the light.
The room was raw concrete block, windowless and empty, save for three steel machinist tables on wheels. On two of them lay bodies covered with plastic sheets. She stood with her back to the open door while they filed past.
"He ain't a friend of yours, is he, Ed Tom?"
"No. He took a couple of rounds in the face, so I don't think he's going to look too good. Not that I ain't seen worse. That highway out there's a goddamn war zone. You tell the truth about it."
He pulled back the sheet. Bell walked around the end of the table. There was no chalk under Moss's neck, and his head was turned to the side. One eye partly opened. He looked like a bad man on a slab. They'd sponged the blood off of him, but there were holes in his face, and his teeth were shot out.
"Is that him?"
"Yeah, that's him."
"You look like you wished it wasn't."
"I get to tell his wife."
"I'm sorry about that."
Bell nodded.
"Well," the sheriff said, "there ain't nothing you could have done about it."
"No," Bell said, "but you always like to think there is."
The sheriff covered Moss's face and reached and lifted back the plastic at the other table and looked at Bell. Bell shook his head.
"They'd rented two rooms, or he did, paid cash. You couldn't read the name on the register, just a scrawl."
"His name was Moss."
"All right. We'll get your information down at the office. Kind of a skanky-looking little old girl."
"Yeah."
He covered her face again.
"I don't reckon his wife is going to like that part of it neither," he said.
"No, I don't expect she will."
The sheriff looked at the nurse. She was still standing, leaning against the door.
"How many times was she hit?" he said. "Do you know?"
"No, I don't, Sheriff. You can look at her if you want. I don't mind, and I know she won't."
"That's all right. It'll be on the autopsy. Are you ready, Ed Tom?"
"Yeah, I was ready before I come in here."
He sat in the sheriff's office alone with the door shut and stared at the phone on the desk. Finally, he got up and went out. The deputy looked up.
"He's gone home, I reckon."
"Yes, sir," the deputy said. "Can I help you with something, Sheriff?"
"How far is it to El Paso?"
"It's about 120 miles.
"You tell him I said thank you, and I'll give him a call tomorrow."
"Yes, sir."
He stopped and ate on the far side of town and sat in the booth and sipped his coffee and watched the lights out on the highway.
Something wrong.
He couldn't make sense out of it. He looked at his watch, 1:20. He paid and walked out and got in the cruiser and sat there. Then he drove to the intersection and turned east and drove back to the motel again. Shiger checked into a motel on the eastbound interstate and walked out across a windy field in the dark and watched across the highway through a pair of binoculars. The big overland trucks loomed up in the glasses and drew away. He squatted on his heels with his elbows on his knees, watching. Then he went back to the motel. He set his alarm for 1 o'clock, and when it went off, he got up and showered and dressed and walked out to his truck with his small leather bag and put it behind the seat. He parked in the motel parking lot, and he sat there for some time, leaning back in the seat and watching in the rearview mirror. Nothing. The police cars were long gone. The yellow police tape across the door lifted in the wind, and the trucks droned past, headed for Arizona and California. He got out and walked up to the door and blew out the lock with his stun gun and walked in and shut the door behind him. He could see the room pretty well by the light through the windows, small spills of light from the bullet holes in the plywood door. He pulled the little bedside table over to the wall and stood and took a screwdriver from his rear pocket and began to back the screws out of the louvered steel cover of the air duct. He set it on the table and reached in and pulled out the bag and stepped down and walked over to the window and looked out at the parking lot. He took the pistol from behind his belt and opened the door and stepped out and closed it behind him and stooped under the tape and walked down to his truck and got in. He set the bag in the floor, and he'd reached for the key to turn on the ignition when he saw the Terrell County Cruiser pull into the lot in front of the motel office 100 feet away. He let go of the key and sat back. The cruiser pulled into a parking space and the lights went out. Then the motor. Chigurh waited, the pistol in his lap. When Bell got out, he took a look around the lot, and then he walked up to the door at 117 and tried the knob. The door was unlocked. He ducked under the tape and pushed the door open and reached and found the wall switch and turned on the light. The first thing he saw was the grill and the screws lying on the table. He shut the door behind him and stood there. He stepped to the window and looked past the edge of the curtain out at the parking lot. He stood there for some time. Nothing moved. He saw something lying in the floor and stepped over and picked it up, but he already knew what it was. He turned it in his hand. He walked over and sat on the bed and weighed the little piece of brass in his palm. Then he tilted it into the ashtray on the bedside table. He picked up the telephone, but the line was dead. He put the receiver back in the cradle. He took his pistol from the holster and flipped open the gate and checked the shells in the cylinder and closed the gate with his thumb and sat with the pistol resting on his knee. "You don't know for sure that he's out there," he said. "Yes, you do. You knew it at the restaurant. That's why you come back here. Well, what do you aim to do?" He got up and walked over and switched off the light. 5 bullet holes in the door. He stood with the revolver in his hand, his thumb on the knurled hammer. Then he opened the door and walked out. He walked to the cruiser, studying the cars in the lot, pickup trucks for the most part. You could always see the muzzle flash first, just not first enough. "Can you feel it when someone is watching you? A lot of people thought so." He reached the cruiser and opened the door with his left hand. The dome light came on. He stepped in and pulled the door shut and laid the pistol on the seat beside him and got out his key and put it in the ignition and started the car. Then he backed out of the parking space and switched on the lights and swung out of the lot. When he was out of sight of the motel, he pulled over onto the shoulder and took the speaker from the hook and called the sheriff's office. They sent 2 cars. He hung the mic up and put the cruiser in neutral and rolled back down the edge of the highway until he could just see the motel sign. He looked at his watch. 1:45. That 7-minute time would make it 1:52. He waited. At the motel, nothing moved. At 1:52, he saw them come down the highway and tail each other up the off-ramp with sirens on and lights blazing. He kept his eyes on the motel. Any vehicle that came out of the lot and headed up the access road, he'd already determined to run it off the road. When the cruisers pulled into the motel, he started the car and turned on the lights and did a U-turn and went back down the road the wrong way and pulled into the lot and got out. They went down the parking lot vehicle by vehicle with flashlights and their guns drawn and came back again. Bell was the first one back and he stood leaning against his cruiser. He nodded to the deputies.
"Gentlemen," he said, "I think we've been out-generaled."
They holstered their pistols. He and the chief deputy walked over to the room and Bell showed him the lock and the air vent and the lock cylinder.
"What's he done that with, Sheriff?" the deputy said, holding the cylinder in his hand.
"It's a long story," Bell said. "I'm sorry to have got you all out here for nothing."
"Not a problem, Sheriff."
"You tell the sheriff I'll call him from El Paso."
"Yes, sir, I'll sure do it."
2 hours later, he checked into the Roadway Inn on the east side of town and got the key and went to his room and went to bed. He woke at 6, as he always did, and got up and closed the curtains and went back to bed, but he couldn't sleep. Finally, he got up and showered and dressed and went down to the coffee shop and got his breakfast and read the paper. There'd be nothing about Moss and the girl yet. When the waitress came with more coffee, he asked her what time they got the evening paper.
"I don't know," she said. "I quit reading it."
"I don't blame you. I would if I could."
"I quit reading it, and I made my husband quit reading it.
Is that right?
I don't know why they call it a newspaper. I don't call that stuff news.
No.
When was the last time you read something about Jesus Christ in the newspaper?
Bell shook his head.
I don't know, he said. I guess I'd have to say it would be a while.
I guess it would, too, she said. A long while.
He'd knocked on other doors with the same sort of message. It wasn't all that new to him. He saw the window curtain move slightly, and then the door opened, and she stood there in jeans with her shirt tail out looking at him. No expression, just waiting. He took off his hat, and she leaned against the door jamb and turned her face away.
"I'm sorry, ma'am," he said.
"Oh, God," she said.
She staggered back into the room and slumped to the floor and buried her face in her forearms with her hands over her head. Bell stood there holding his hat. He didn't know what to do. He couldn't see any sign of the mother. Two Spanish maids were standing in the parking lot, watching and whispering to each other. He stepped into the room and closed the door.
"Carla Jean," he said.
"Oh, God," she said.
"I'm just as sorry as I can be."
"Oh, God."
He stood there, his hat in his hand.
"I'm sorry," he said.
She raised her head and looked at him, her crumpled face.
"Damn you," she said. "You stand there and tell me you're sorry? My husband is dead. Do you understand that? You say you're sorry one more time, and by God, if I won't get my gun and shoot you."
Part 9.
I had to take her at her word. Not a lot else you could do. I never saw her again. I wanted to tell her that the way they had it in the papers wasn't right, about him and that girl. It turned out she was a runaway, 15 years old. I don't believe that he had anything to do with her, and I hated that she thought that, which you know she did. I called her a number of times, but she'd hang up on me, and I can't blame her. Then when they called me from Odessa and told me what had happened, I couldn't hardly believe it. It didn't make no sense. I drove up there, but there wasn't nothing to be done. Her grandmother had just died, too. I tried to see if I could get his fingerprints off the FBI database, but they just drew a blank. Wanted to know what his name was and what he'd done and all such as that. You end up looking like a fool. He's a ghost. But he's out there. You wouldn't think it would be possible to just come and go that away. I keep waiting to hear something else. Maybe I will yet, or maybe not. It's easy to fool yourself, tell yourself what you want to hear. You wake up in the night and you think about things. I ain't sure anymore what it is I do want to hear. You tell yourself that maybe this business is over, but you know it ain't. You can wish all you want. My daddy always told me to just do the best you knew how and tell the truth. He said there was nothing to set a man's mind at ease like waking up in the morning and not having to decide who you were. And if you'd done something wrong, just stand up and say you done it and say you're sorry and get on with it. Don't haul stuff around with you. I guess all that sounds pretty simple today, even to me. All the more reason to think about it. He didn't say a lot, so I tend to remember what he did say, and I don't remember that he had a lot of patience with having to say things twice, so I learned to listen the first time. I might have strayed from all of that some as a younger man, but when I got back on that road, I pretty much decided not to quit again, and I didn't. I think the truth is always simple. It has pretty much got to be. It needs to be simple enough for a child to understand. Otherwise, it'd be too late. By the time you figured it out, it would be too late.
Chigurh stood at the receptionist's desk, dressed in suit and tie.
He set the case in the floor at his feet and looked around the office.
"How do you spell that?" she said. He told her. "Is he expecting you?"
"No, he's not. But he's going to be glad to see me."
"Just a minute."
She buzzed the inner office. There was a silence. Then she hung up the phone.
"Go right in," she said.
He opened the door and walked in, and a man at the desk stood up and looked at him. He came around the desk and held out his hand.
"I know that name," he said.
They sat on a sofa in the corner of the office, and Shiger set the case on the coffee table and nodded at it.
"That's yours," he said.
"What is it?"
"It's some money that belongs to you."
The man sat looking at the case. Then he got up and went over to the desk and leaned and pushed a button.
"Hold my calls," he said.
He turned and put his hands on either side of the desk behind him and leaned back and studied Shiger.
"How did you find me?" he said.
"What difference does it make?"
"It makes a difference to me."
"You don't have to worry. Nobody else is coming."
"How do you know?"
"Because I'm in charge of who is coming and who is not. I think we need to address the issue here. I don't want to spend a lot of time trying to put your mind at ease. I think it would be both hopeless and thankless. So let's talk about money."
"All right."
"Some of it is missing, about $100,000. Part of that was stolen, and part of it went to cover my expenses. I've been at some pains to recover your property, so I'd prefer not to be addressed as some sort of bearer of bad news here. There is $2.3 million in that case. I'm sorry I couldn't recover it all. But there you are."
The man hadn't moved. After a while, he said,
"Who the hell are you?"
"My name is Anton Shiger."
"I know that."
"Then why did you ask?"
"What do you want? I guess that's my question."
"Well, I'd say that the purpose of my visit is simply to establish my bona fides as someone who is an expert in a difficult field, as someone who is completely reliable and completely honest, something like that."
"Someone I might do business with?"
"Yes."
"You're serious?"
"Completely."
Shiger watched him. He watched the dilation in his eyes and the pulse in the artery of his neck, the rate of his breathing. When he'd first put his hands on the desk behind him, he'd looked somewhat relaxed. He was still standing in the identical attitude, but he didn't look that way anymore.
"There's not a bomb in that damn bag, is there?"
"No. No bombs."
Shiger undid the straps and unlatched the brass hasp and opened the leather flap and tipped the case forward.
"Yes," the man said. "Put that away."
Shiger closed the bag. The man stood up from his leaning against the desk. He wiped his mouth with his foreknuckle.
"I think what you need to consider," Shiger said, "is how you lost this money in the first place, who you listened to, and what happened when you did."
"Yes. We can't talk here."
"I understand. In any case, I don't expect you to absorb all this at one sitting. I'll call you in 2 days' time."
"All right."
Shiger rose from the couch. The man nodded toward the case.
"You could do a lot of business on your own with that," he said.
Shiger smiled.
"We have a lot to talk about," he said. "We'll be dealing with new people now. There won't be any more problems."
"What happened to the old people?"
"They've moved on to other things. Not everyone is suited to this line of work. The prospect of outsized profits leads people to exaggerate their own capabilities in their minds. They pretend to themselves that they are in control of events where perhaps they are not. And it is always one's stance upon uncertain ground that invites the attentions of one's enemies or discourages it."
"And you? What about your enemies?"
"I have no enemies. I don't permit such a thing."
He looked around the room.
"Nice office," he said. "Low key."
He nodded to a painting on the wall.
"Is that original?"
The man looked at the painting.
"No," he said, "it's not. But I own the original. I keep it in a vault."
"Excellent,"
said Shiger.
The funeral was on a cold and windy day in March. She stood beside her grandmother's sister. The sister's husband sat in front of her in a wheelchair with his chin resting in his hand. The dead woman had more friends than she would have reckoned. She was surprised. They'd come with their faces veiled in black. She put her hand on her uncle's shoulder, and he reached up across his chest and patted it. She'd thought maybe he was asleep. The whole while that the wind blew and the preacher talked, she had the feeling that someone was watching her. Twice, she even looked around. It was dark when she got home. She went into the kitchen and put the kettle on and sat at the kitchen table. She hadn't felt like crying. Now she did. She lowered her face into her folded arms.
"Oh, Mama," she said.
When she went upstairs and turned on the light in her bedroom, Sugar was sitting at the little desk waiting for her. She stood in the doorway, her hand falling slowly away from the wall switch. He moved not at all. She stood there, holding her hat. Finally, she said,
"I knowed this wasn't done with."
Smart girl.
"I ain't got it."
"Got what?"
"I need to sit down."
Sugar nodded toward the bed. She sat and put her hat on the bed beside her, and then picked it up again and held it to her.
"Too late," Sugar said.
"I know."
"What is it that you haven't got?"
"I think you know what I'm talking about."
"How much do you have?"
"I don't have none of it. I had about $7,000 all told, and I can tell you it's been long gone, and these bills are plenty left to pay yet. I buried my mother today. I ain't paid for that neither."
"I wouldn't worry about it."
She looked at the bedside table.
"It's not there," he said.
She sat slumped forward, holding her hat in her arms.
"You've got no cause to hurt me," she said.
"I know, but I gave my word."
"Your word?"
"Yes. We're at the mercy of the dead here. In this case, your husband."
"That don't make no sense."
"I'm afraid it does."
"I don't have the money. You know I ain't got it."
"I know."
"You give your word to my husband to kill me?"
"Yes."
"He's dead. My husband is dead."
"Yes, but I'm not."
"You don't owe nothing to dead people."
Sugar cocked his head slightly.
"No," he said.
"How can you?"
"How can you not?"
"They're dead."
"Yes, but my word is not dead. Nothing can change that."
"You can change it."
"I don't think so. Even a non-believer might find it useful to model himself after God. Very useful, in fact."
"You're just a blasphemer."
"Hard words. But what's done cannot be undone. I think you understand that. Your husband, you may be distressed to learn, had the opportunity to remove you from harm's way, and he chose not to do so. He was given that option, and his answer was no. Otherwise, I would not be here now."
"You aim to kill me."
"I'm sorry."
She put the hat down on the bed and turned and looked out the window. The new green of the trees and the light of the vapor lamp in the yard bending and writing again in the evening wind.
"I don't know what I ever done," she said. "I truly don't."
Sugar nodded.
"Probably you do," he said. "There's a reason for everything."
She shook her head.
"How many times I've said them very words. I won't again."
"You've suffered a loss of faith."
"I've suffered a loss of everything I ever had." "My husband wanted to kill me?"
"Yes." "Is there anything that you'd like to say?"
"To who?"
"I'm the only one here."
"I don't have nothing to say to you."
You'll be all right. Try not to worry about it.
What?
I see your look, he said. It doesn't make any difference what sort of person I am, you know. You shouldn't be more frightened to die because you think I'm a bad person.
I knowed you was crazy when I seen you sitting there, she said. I knowed exactly what was in store for me, even if I couldn't have said it.
Sugar smiled.
It's a hard thing to understand, he said. I see people struggle with it. The look they get. They always say the same thing.
What do they say?
They say, you don't have to do this.
You don't.
It's not any help, though, is it?
No.
So why do you say it?
I ain't never said it before.
Any of you?
There's just me, she said. There ain't nobody else.
Yes, of course.
She looked at the gun. She turned away. She sat with her head down, her shoulders shaking.
Oh, Mama,
she said.
None of this was your fault.
She shook her head, sobbing.
You didn't do anything. It was bad luck.
She nodded. He watched her, his chin in his hand.
All right, he said. This is the best I can do.
He straightened out his leg and reached into his pocket and drew out a few coins and took one and held it up. He turned it for her to see the justice of it. He held it between his thumb and forefinger and weighed it, and then flipped it, spinning in the air, and caught it and slapped it down on his wrist.
Call it, he said.
She looked at him, at his outheld wrist.
What?
She said.
Call it.
I won't do it.
Yes, you will call it.
God would not want me to do that.
Of course he would. You should try to save yourself. Call it. This is your last chance.
Heads,
she said. He lifted his hand away. The coin was tails.
I'm sorry.
She didn't answer.
Maybe it's for the best.
She looked away.
You make it like it was the coin, but you're the one.
It could have gone either way.
The coin didn't have no say. It was just you.
Perhaps. But look at it my way. I got here the same way the coin did.
She sat sobbing softly. She didn't answer.
For things at a common destination, there is a common path, not always easy to see, but there.
Everything I ever thought has turned out different, she said. There ain't the least part of my life I could have guessed. Not this. Not none of it.
I know.
You wouldn't have let me off no way.
I had no say in the matter. Every moment in your life is a turning and everyone a choosing. Somewhere you made a choice, all followed to this. The accounting is scrupulous. The shape is drawn. No line can be erased. I had no belief in your ability to move a coin to your bidding. How could you? A person's path through the world seldom changes, and even more seldom will it change abruptly. And the shape of your path was visible from the beginning.
She sat sobbing. She shook her head.
Yet even though I could have told you how all of this would end, I thought it not too much to ask that you have a final glimpse of hope in the world, to lift your heart before the shroud drops, the darkness. Do you see?
Oh, God,
she said.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry.
She looked at him a final time.
You don't have to,
she said.
You don't. You don't.
He shook his head.
You're asking that I make myself vulnerable, and that I can never do. I have only one way to live. It doesn't allow for special cases. A coin toss, perhaps.
in this case, to small purpose. Most people don't believe that there can be such a person. You can see what a problem that must be for them, how to prevail over that which you refuse to acknowledge the existence of. Do you understand? When I came into your life was over. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. This is the end. You can say that things could have turned out differently, that they could have been some other way, but what does that mean? They are not some other way. They are this way. You're asking that I second say the world. Do you see?
Yes, she said, sobbing. I do. I truly do.
Good, he said. That's good. Then he shot her. The car that hit Sugar in the intersection three blocks from the house was a 10-year-old Buick that had run a stop sign. There were no skid marks at the site, and the vehicle had made no attempt to brake. Sugar never wore a seatbelt driving in the city because of just such hazards, and although he saw the vehicle coming and threw himself to the other side of the truck, the impact carried the caved-in driver's side door to him instantly and broke his arm in two places and broke some ribs and cut his head and his leg. He crawled out of the passenger side door and staggered to the sidewalk and sat in the grass of someone's lawn and looked at his arm. Bone sticking up under the skin, not good. A woman in a house dress ran out screaming. Blood kept running into his eyes, and he tried to think. He held the arm and turned it and tried to see how badly it was bleeding, if the median artery were severed. He thought not. His head was ringing. No pain. Not yet. Two teenage boys were standing there, looking at him.
Are you all right, mister?
Yeah, he said. I'm all right. Let me just sit here a minute.
There's an ambulance coming. Man over yonder went to call one.
All right.
You sure you're all right?
Sugar looked at them. What will you take for that shirt? He said.
They looked at each other.
What shirt?
Any damn shirt. How much?
He straightened out his leg and reached in his pocket and got out his money clip.
I need something to wrap around my head, and I need a sling for this arm.
One of the boys began to unbutton his shirt.
Hell, mister, why didn't you say so? I'll give you my shirt.
Sugar took the shirt and bit into it and ripped it in two down the back. He wrapped his head in a bandana and he twisted the other half of the shirt into a sling and put his arm in it.
Tie this for me, he said.
They looked at each other.
Just tie it.
The boy in the T-shirt stepped forward and knelt and knotted the sling.
Light arm don't look good, he said.
Sugar thumbed a bill out of the clip and put the clip back in his pocket and took the bill from between his teeth and got to his feet and held it out.
Hell, mister, I don't mind helping somebody out. That's a lot of money.
Take it. Take it, and you don't know what I look like. You hear?
The boy took the bill.
Yes, sir, he said.
They watched him set off up the sidewalk, holding the twist of the bandana against his head, limping slightly.
Part of that's mine, the other boy said. You still got your damn shirt. That ain't what it was for. That may be, but I'm still out of shirt.
They walked out into the street where the vehicles sat steaming. The street lamps had come on. A pool of green antifreeze was collecting in the gutter. When they passed the open door of Sugar's truck, the one in the T-shirt stopped the other with his hand.
You see what I see? He said. Shit,
the other one said. What they saw was Sugar's pistol lying in the floorboard of the truck. They could already hear the sirens in the distance.
Get it,
the first one said. Go on.
Why me? I ain't got a shirt to cover it with.
Go on. Hurry.
He climbed the three wooden steps to the porch and tapped loosely at the door with the back of his hand. He took off his hat and pressed his shirt sleeve against his forehead and put his hat back on again.
Come in,
a voice called. He opened the door and stepped into the cool darkness.
Ellis?
I'm back here. Come on back.
He walked through the kitchen. The old man was sitting beside the table in his chair.
The room smelled of old bacon grease and stale wood smoke from the stove, and over it all lay a faint tang of urine, like the smell of cats, but it wasn't just cats. Bell stood in the doorway and took his hat off. The old man looked up at him, one clouded eye from a cholia spine where a horse had thrown him years ago.
"Hey, Ed Tom," he said. "I didn't know who that was."
"How you making it?"
"You're looking at it. You by yourself?"
"Yes, sir."
"Sit down. You want some coffee?"
Bell looked at the clutter on the checked oilcloth. Bottles of medicine, breadcrumbs, quarter horse magazines.
"Thank you, no," he said. "I appreciate it."
"I had a letter from your wife."
"You can call her Loretta."
"I know I can." "Did you know she writes me?"
"I guess I knew she'd wrote you a time or two."
"It's more than a time or two. She writes pretty regular. Tells me the family news."
"I didn't know there was any."
"You might be surprised."
"So, what was special about this letter then?"
"She just told me you was quitting, that's all. Sit down."
The old man didn't watch to see if he would or he wouldn't. He fell to rolling himself a cigarette from a sack of tobacco at his elbow. He twisted the end in his mouth and turned it around and lit it with an old Zippo lighter worn through to the brass. He sat smoking, holding the cigarette pencil-wise in his fingers.
"Are you all right?" Bell said.
"I'm all right."
He wheeled the chair slightly sideways and watched Bell through the smoke.
"I got to say, you look older," he said.
"I am older."
The old man nodded. Bell had pulled out a chair and sat, and he put his hat on the table.
"Let me ask you something," he said.
"All right."
"What's your biggest regret in life?"
The old man looked at him, gauging the question.
"I don't know," he said. "I ain't got all that many regrets. I could imagine lots of things that you might think would make a man happier. I reckon being able to walk around might be one." "You can make up your own list. You might even have one. I think by the time you're grown, you're as happy as you're going to be. You'll have good times and bad times, but in the end you'll be about as happy as you was before, or as unhappy. I've knowed people that just never did get the hang of it."
"I know what you mean."
"I know you do."
The old man smoked.
"If what you're asking me is what made me the unhappiest, then I think you already know that."
"Yes, sir."
"And it ain't this chair, and it ain't this cotton eye."
"Yes, sir, I know that."
"You sign on for the ride, you probably think you got at least some notion of where the ride's going. But you might not. Or you might have been lied to. Probably nobody would blame you then, if you quit. But if it's just that it turned out to be a little rougher than what you had in mind, well, that's something else."
Bell nodded.
"I guess some things are better not put to the test."
"I guess that's right."
"What would it take to run Loretta off?"
"I don't know. I guess I'd have to do something that was pretty bad. It damn sure wouldn't be just 'cause things got a little rough. She's done been there a time or two."
Ellis nodded. He tipped the ash from his smoke into a jar lid on the table.
"I'll take your word on that," he said.
Bell smiled. He looked around.
"How fresh is that coffee?"
"I think it's all right. I generally make a fresh pot here every week, even if there is some left over."
Bell smiled again and rose and carried the pot to the counter and plugged it in. They sat at the table drinking coffee out of the same crazed porcelain cups that had been in that house since before he was born. Bell looked at the cup and he looked around the kitchen.
"Well," he said, "some things don't change, I reckon."
"What would that be?"
the old man said.
"Hell, I don't know."
"I don't either."
"How many cats you got?"
"Several. Depends on what you mean by got. Some of 'em are half wild and the rest are just outlaws. They run out the door when they heard your truck."
"Did you hear the truck?"
"How's that?"
"I said, did you..."
You're having a little fun with me. What give you that idea? Did you? No. I seen the cat skedaddle. You want some more of this? I'm done. The man that shot you died in prison. In Angola, yes. What would you have done if he'd been released? I don't know. Nothing. There wouldn't be no point to it. There ain't no point to it. Not to any of it. I'm kindly surprised to hear you say that. You wear out, Ed Tom. All the time you spend trying to get back what's been took from you, there's more going out the door. After a while, you just try and get a tourniquet on it. Your granddad never asked me to sign on as deputy with him. I done that my own self. Hell, I didn't have nothing else to do. Paid about the same as cowboying. Anyway, you never know what worse luck your bad luck has saved you from. I was too young for one war and too old for the next one. But I seen what come out of it. You can be patriotic and still believe that some things cost more than what they're worth. Ask them Gold Star mothers what they paid and what they got for it. You always pay too much, particularly for promises. There ain't no such thing as a bargain promise, you'll see. Maybe you done have.
Bell didn't answer.
I always thought, when I got older, that God would sort of come into my life in some way. He didn't. I don't blame him. If I was him, I'd have the same opinion about me that he does.
You don't know what he thinks.
Yes, I do.
He looked at Bell.
I can remember one time you come to see me after y'all had moved to Denton. You walked in and you looked around and you asked me what I intended to do.
All right.
You wouldn't ask me now, though, would you?
Maybe not.
You wouldn't.
He sipped the rank black coffee.
You ever think about Harold?
Bell said.
Harold?
Yes.
Not much. He was some older than me. He was born in 99, pretty sure that's right. What made you think about Harold?
I was reading some of your mother's letters to him, that's all. I just wondered what you remembered about him.
Was there any letters from him?
No.
You think about your family. Try to make sense out of all that. I know what it did to my mother. She never got over it. I don't know what sense any of it makes. You know that gospel song, "We'll Understand It All By and By"? That takes a lot of faith. You think about him going over there and dying in a ditch somewheres. 17-year-old. You tell me, 'cause I damn sure don't know.
I hear you. Did you want to go somewheres?
I don't need nobody hauling me around. I aim to just sit right here. I'm fine, Ed Tom.
It ain't no trouble.
I know it.
All right.
Bell watched him. The old man stubbed out a cigarette in the lid. Bell tried to think about his life. Then he tried not to.
You ain't turned infidel, have you, Uncle Ellis?
No. Nothing like that.
Do you think God knows what's happening?
I expect he does.
You think he can stop it?
No, I don't.
They sat quietly at the table. After a while, the old man said,
"She mentioned there was a lot of old pictures and family stuff. What to do about it? Well, there ain't nothing to do about it, I don't reckon. Is there?"
"No, I don't reckon there is."
"I told her to send Uncle Mac's old Cinco Peso badge and his thumb buster to the Rangers. I believe they've got a museum. But I didn't know what to tell her. There's all that stuff here, in the chiffon robe in yonder. That roll-top desk is full of papers."
He tilted the cup and looked into the bottom of it.
"He never rode with Coffee Jack, Uncle Mac. That's all bull. I don't know who started that. He was shot down on his own porch in Hudspeth County. That's what I always heard. They was 7 or 8 of 'em come to the house, wanting this and wanting that. He went back in the house and come out with a shotgun, but they was way ahead of 'em, and they shot him down in his own doorway. She run out and tried to stop the bleeding, tried to get him back in the house. Said he kept trying to get hold of the shotgun again. They just sat there on their horses, finally left. I don't know why. Something scared 'em, I reckon. One of 'em said something in Injun, and they all turned and left out. They never come in the house or nothing. She got 'em inside, but he was a big man, and there was no way she could have got 'em up in the bed. She fixed a pallet on the floor. Wasn't nothing to be done. She always said she should have just left him there and rode for hell, but I don't know where it was she would have rode to. He wouldn't have let her go no way. Wouldn't hardly let her go in the kitchen. He knew what the score was if she didn't. He was shot through the right lung. And that was that, as they say. When did he die? 1879. No, I mean, was it right away or in the night or when was it?
I believe it was that night, or early of the morning. She buried him herself, digging in that hard caliche. Then she just packed the wagon and hitched the horses and pulled out of there, and she never did go back. That house burned down sometime back in the '20s, what hadn't fell down. I could take you to it today. The rock chimney used to be standing, and it may be yet. There's a good bit of land proved up on. 8 or 10 sections, if I remember. She couldn't pay the taxes on it, little as they was. Couldn't sell it. Did you remember her?
No. I seen a photograph of me with her when I was about 4. She's sitting in a rocker on the porch of this house, and I'm standing alongside of her. I wish I could say I remember her, but I don't.
She never did remarry. Later years, she was a school teacher, San Angelo. This country was hard on people, but they never seemed to hold it to account. In a way, that seems peculiar, that they didn't. You think about what all has happened to just this one family. I don't know what I'm doing here, still knocking around, all them young people. We don't know where half of 'em is even buried at. You got to ask what was the good and all that. So I go back to that. How come people don't feel like this country has got a lot to answer for? They don't. You can say that the country is just the country, it don't actively do nothing, but that don't mean much. I seen a man shoot his pickup truck with a shotgun one time. He must have thought it done something. This country will kill you in a heartbeat, and still people love it. You understand what I'm saying?
I think I do. Do you love it?
I guess you could say I do. But I'd be the first one to tell you I'm as ignorant as a box of rocks, so you sure don't want to go by nothing I'd say.
Bell smiled. He got up and went to the sink. The old man turned the chair slightly to where he could see him.
What are you doing?
He said.
I thought I'd just wash these here dishes.
Hell, leave 'em, Ed Tom. Lupe'll be here in the morning.
It won't take but a minute.
The water from the tap was gyp water. He filled the sink and added a scoop of soap powder. Then he added another.
I thought you used to have a television set in here.
I used to have a lot of things.
Why didn't you say something? I'll get you one.
I don't need one.
Keep you company some.
It didn't quit on me. I throwed it out.
You don't never watch the news?
No. Do you?
Not much.
He rinsed the dishes and left them in the drain and stood looking out the window at the little weed-grown yard, a weathered smokehouse, an aluminum two-horse trailer on blocks.
You used to have chickens, he said.
Yep,
the old man said.